Welcome everybody to the Emo Over Easy podcast. I'm Andy Little, joined by my co-host John.
Hello. How are you? Hello, I'm
John Casey, if you need both parts of his name.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, just in case.
And we've got recurrent guest Jeff Comp with us. Jeff, how are you?
I'm doing so well. Thank you so much. I'm excited.
And we are here with a new guest to the show, Jason Brooks. Jason, how are you?
I'm doing great, guys. Great to be with you.
So Jason Brooks, give him a little bit of a pump up. First time I met Jason was at Rebel EM in 2019. He gave one of the keynotes there and gave a really cool talk about EM providers and how we can change our mindsets to be better providers. It was a really good talk, very thoughtful. And then as happenstance, fast forward 5 years, as the conference chair for CORD, Academic Assembly 2024 here in New Orleans, I had the pleasure and opportunity to invite Jason to come be our keynote for this. And Jason's background is in performance science. He works with clinicians. He's actually from Winnipeg, Canada. I would say that with the worst Canadian accent ever, but I don't want to offend one of our co-hosts, Tanner Ganowski, whose wife is a native Canadian. So Jason, tell us a little bit about what you do, and then we'll kind of dive in and have some questions.
Well, I'm from Winnipeg, eh? That's the start. So yeah, I've been doing this type of work for almost 25 years, 24 to be exact. High performance coaching that also lends itself towards personal development coaching. I first got into this, I think, if you want to go all the way back, as a good but not great athlete, I think was what drove me to learn more about the psychology of performance and looking for an advantage any type I could for the sports that I played. And it led me to really just have a fascination for the whole idea of, you know, there's the physical side of performance, but there's the mental. And you hear all the time, all the cliches, oh, you know, it's 99% mental. But then you talk to people and you go, well, how much mental preparation do you do then? None. It just seems to me that, you know, maybe there's an inconsistency there. So long story short, I started to pursue it in university. And I will say one thing about Winnipeg. If you were looking to do this for a career, it was the best place to go. I had two mentors who were so keen to give me opportunities at an undergrad level that by the time I pursued this at higher levels, master's, PhD, you know, I had a ton of reps behind me. So I got into the field mostly through performance, working with high-level athletes and coaches and teams. But at some point, you just start to realize, you know, it's all just human performance, really. And you look at other performance arenas and you think, well, you know, the person giving the big sales pitch, the physician who's in a high-stakes situation in emergency medicine, the performance artist who's dealing with butterflies, it's all the same reactions as human beings to some of the environmental and, you know, mental challenges that we all face. So it just became somewhat instinctive, I guess, to figure out, well, why don't I explore some of these ideas and strategies with folks in other performance arenas? So I started to work in business and performance arts and military and SWAT teams and all the rest of it. And at that same time, my mentor, Dr. Cal Barro, who's a legend in the field of sport and performance psychology, got an opportunity, was invited to participate in a study sponsored by a patient safety group at the University of Manitoba and the Faculty of Medicine. And they were curious to see, does any of this high performance stuff have any relevance to what we do here? So the study was set up as a pre and post simulation based study. And they measured a bunch of doctors, and they were from different backgrounds, actually. It wasn't all merge or whatever. And it was sort of a pre and post just to see, okay, the pre was to put them under those high stakes situations in sim, see how they respond. And then my mentor delivered, I think it was 4 or 5 sessions in and around performance psychology and sort of trying as best we could to meld it towards the conditions that you all face, which was new for us as well. And the feedback was awesome. And the study showed, you know, tons of significance, particularly from the qualitative aspect. You know, people said, I don't know necessarily if in 4 sessions I'm, you know, my skills are better, but I just feel so much better able to handle some of the other stuff that comes with it. And pretty much from that point on, I've never not worked in medicine. That's over 16 years ago. And it's amazing to see. And I'll say this, I continue to work in all the performance arenas, but medicine is special to me because I always like to say, and it's funny, I was asked this at a medical conference before even meeting you, Andy, at SMAC in 2015. Someone said, could you compare and contrast what it's like? And they said specifically working with high-level athletes and then working with physicians. I said, it's a great question. I said, the biggest thing I will say is this. Physicians to me are amongst the most impressive human performers I have ever been around. Not because of what you know and what you can do, that is impressive. But to me, it's what you know and what you can do in spite of the conditions as they are. In sport, we would take any one of you, we would wrap you in a cocoon of support. You would have a strength coach, a nutritionist, a psychologist, whatever you need to be great and to optimize that. And every single person would have one explicit goal, and that's to work in that direction. And I think what I see in medicine a lot is that the performance side, what you're able to do, is exceedingly incredible. You know, consistently you get the results, but you're doing it again within a confine that is challenging, to say the least. And, you know, here we are post-pandemic, a lot of the system level things that are, you know, really the big pillars that need to move, and here you are. And yet, even in spite of that, the job gets done, and it gets done well. So I'll say a strong statement. I don't mean it as an indictment, but someone asked me further and pressed me on it. I said, well, I guess you could say the performers in medicine are amongst the very best, but I would not call medicine a high performance culture simply because the conditions are so difficult for people. Oftentimes you're performing in spite of it, which is not ideal.
I like that. I don't think that's a harsh statement at all. I think it's a very true statement. I think regular listeners to our podcast have probably experienced that, and anybody that's currently practicing. The current environment is not ideal for high performers. High performers, I think what you're alluding to is they find a way to make it work. One of the things we spend a lot of time working with, though, and talking about is what's the cost of that? Because if you don't have your counselor, your nutritionist, your physical training coach, you're taking all those jobs, that energy and space is coming from somewhere else. And is that your personal life? Is that your downtime, your vacation time, your, you know, going to see your kids play soccer time? Like, what is that? So I think it's a great statement. It's actually refreshing to hear someone actually say it out loud that is in medicine, but in a different way than I think the rest of us that are practicing do.
And it also allows for us to understand that this is something that we can be working on. Right? We've gone to school for such a long time with one specific goal and topic that we've all been learning about. And I just started learning about human performance just because I was interested in it. And to have people that are outside of medicine say, hey, these are things that you can be doing. Here are some strategies. Here are some techniques that will help you improve either your performance. And whatever that means, is that your performance as a person, as a physician, as a family member, how do you optimize some of these tasks that you're doing to allow for space for other growth?
So, Jason, you've been involved with clinicians for 16 years. I imagine you've got a ton of stories and a ton of experience. When we talk about high performers in medicine and then us working in incomplete systems, where have you seen high performers get in trouble? Because when I listen to your talk at Rebel and then watch some of your other stuff that's online, it's the... Because we are high performers and we're working in systems that are, we can say broken because they are, we have a high risk of performing ourselves out of being in sync health-wise, mental-wise, personal life-wise. So when you've worked with high-performing physicians and high performers in all realms, where do you see physicians get it wrong in terms of catching ourselves when we perform ourselves out of our job?
I think there's a few things I would say to that. And maybe I'll, you said with some stories. I had a good mentor of mine always said, you need to have a store of stories in this field. So I was involved in a research project this last year. I don't know if I can say the university. It's West Coast US just yet, but the whole gist of the study was looking at physician burnout and wanting to see whether or not, in this case, if some coaching services might provide some protections against some of what you're saying. And so for the last years, myself and another person worked with nearly 190 something physicians out on the West Coast. And we gave them 6 sessions each, just trying to see. And these are people who identified as at or near the threshold of burnout and just trying to see what we can do. And again, you hear story after story and it's the same old. The conditions are making it so difficult to sustain myself and there's nothing I can do. And yet I still answer the call every single day. And so for me, there's 2 things that we need to look at. Can we do something specific to change the conditions? There's only so many levers we can work from. You think of the conditions, you can try and fix the conditions, you can leave the conditions, and you might say, well, what is this guy saying? Well, I'll tell you what, with a field that has the highest incidence of suicide, I'd much rather someone left and found something they could do and sustain than stay in it and suffer something worse than burnout. So you could leave it. It is an option. I think most people, though, are not going to. So what's the best way that we can adjust and adapt to the conditions as they are? And I think what I've seen, especially over the last several years, the conditions have worsened, obviously, which is taking a toll on the providers. They still answer the call, right? You're still going to do it. But it's the internal perspective that I think is really getting people into trouble. And I'll illustrate that with a story. So one of the people who took part in this project, and we were talking about these things, and they said, oh, you know, they were telling me about something that was pissing them off, you know, that day. And I said, I got to tell you something, you know, I've been running a clinic here at wherever they are for 5 years. And for 5 years, I've run this clinic, whatever, Monday mornings from 8 till 12. Not one time ever has the clinic finished before 1 o'clock. And then in the next breath, and this is bullshit, and this is ridiculous, and medicine takes too much for me, and this is not right, and that's where I could be having my lunch or doing my emails, and now I'm going to be home later to my kids. And you just get a sense of all the frustration that's embedded in one little factor in their job. And so I said, you know, I had a lot of empathy for this person. It's not right that it's that way. I mean, all the things this person's saying is true. So I said, well, let's see if we can figure a better way through. I said, so is there anything that we could actually do to change the conditions? You know, is it the case that maybe whoever's booking this just doesn't appreciate that it goes later? Maybe they do appreciate and don't care. I don't know what the thing is, but is there anything that you could actually do to change the conditions more along the lines of what you need and want? And he thought about it for a second. He said, I've thought about that a million times. And he said, the honest answer is no. The fact of if I did that, number one, you know, booking 6 months out, so patients would be sicker by the time they come around. Number two, I guess whatever his particular role is, when he's done with someone, they go on to someone else. So he'd be putting that person behind. So he had assessed for himself, there's nothing I could do to change the condition. That's the way it's going to be. I said, okay. So it obviously frustrates you. You know, is the juice still worth the squeeze? I mean, you don't have to do this thing. Tell me about that. And he said, oh, are you kidding me? He said, this is my favorite part of medicine. This clinic is the thing that gives me the juice. There's no way I could ever give this up. Forget it. I said, okay, no problem. Let's just see where we're at. So we have no ability to change the conditions in the way that you would like to see. And yet in spite of that, you have no willingness or desire to leave it. I said, for your consideration, what if you decided that from this point forward, clinic ended at 1 o'clock? And there was this long pause and then a smile, because in that moment, he realized he'd been fighting a ghost. And that's not to say that the conditions aren't bad and shouldn't be that way, but he's bringing a set of expectations, a perspective on the conditions that doesn't fit the reality. And so when we fight reality, you're going to lose 100% of the time. So I don't like the fact that it seems to me that every solution in medicine is to adjust and adapt to conditions that aren't ideal. But at the same time, if that's where our power is now, if that's where the agency is, God, could we help ourselves? Half the frustration could maybe be dissolved if we just don't perseverate on something that we can't change. Speaking about it in those terms is really come on even more so during COVID, because again, the conditions are so challenging. This is what we can do, you know? I wish, I'll tell it in my keynote on tomorrow, I wish I had a slide that made more senior nurses appear or better workflow solutions. I don't have that slide. Nobody here has that ability to just make it happen. So until the big picture things changed at the system level, could we do an even better job of helping ourselves stay in it? So to me, that's where I think, you know, the idea of when people get in trouble. And then you look at other folks, you know, someone that we all know and love, Dr. Salim Rezai, another good example. Here's a guy, high profile, doing every single thing that there is, et cetera, and then just decided, you know what? I don't want to do that anymore. And set some guardrails and put some boundaries in place and changed the way he did things and dropped his EFT and did a few other things. And again, I like that because it shows you that I think a lot of times we get caught up in everything's bad and there's nothing I can do. And if you tell yourself there's nothing you can do, guess what you'll consider doing? Nothing. And it works great. Everything stays the same until we decide, you know what? What is the tipping point for each person? And long before I want someone to get to the point of burnout where they leave the field, could we be a bit more assertive and aggressive in terms of protecting ourselves within the system?
It's interesting to certainly, I do nowhere near the high level intervention stuff you do, but I think all of us that have gone through residency, you do some aspect of what we would consider coaching. And I think it's so cool what you pointed out. And it's interesting for me because a few days ago, I had a very similar conversation with someone about a completely different topic, but it was the same idea of being able to adjust and control your own perspective, right? If A can't be true and B can't be changed, and you still want to do both of those, what are we doing? And the funny thing is that what I see over and over, and when I hear my colleagues talk about it, and the things that I've done myself when I needed coaching through a situation, is it's always, you are often taught to think that you can just outthink it as a doctor, that you can come up with a smarter way, a better way. If they just did it, they, whoever they are, if they just did it your way, it would be better for everyone and everything would be better. And it's really funny when you start to see that. And it sounds like this physician that you were coaching had this realization, like, well, no, I mean, if I do this, then it helps me, but it really doesn't help my patients. And then the nurses don't, right? So again, that I think is where that frustration comes in for a lot of people, is that a lot of times they've thought to the end of what they think they can think. The problem being that they don't see just this little tweak where they could be the other way. And I'm sure that's got to be a rewarding feeling, like when we get a resuscitation and we get them back, it's probably your version of that, right? Like when you see their eyes light up, like that's an insight. So I do think that, because I've also talked to some people about coaching or a therapist or just a good buddy that you go work out with or whatever it is, you know, different forms of coaching come in different ways. And it's really funny the resistance you get to it sometimes. You know, oh, I don't need that. I know what I need to do. I just need to buckle down and do it. And then 5 years later, you go, how's that working out for you? Yeah, you had it figured out. When you gonna do that? So I think it's a great example.
If I could,
I love
just
it.
Add to that, John, it's funny to say that. So in early days of doing this in medicine, for example, and I was mentioning working with my mentor, Dr. Cal Botterill, and he was sort of leading it when he invited me in on the thing. And we'd have a audience full, theater full of, you know, physicians that we were giving some lecture to. And one of the things that he would do this progressive relaxation script. So you can imagine, you can download these things on YouTube, some soft music, and you have someone, it's so funny, the version he had sounded like a professor from 1950, just like very monotone and, you know, that sort of voice. But it was, the gist of it is, as soon as he would say this to a room filled with physicians, you could feel the collective eye roll, just like, what is this bullshit? I mean, God, I don't need this. I'm doing just fine. In 3 minutes, after begrudgingly allowing themselves to go through this, to a person, every single one of them was in a puddle of themselves, because it's the first time they felt what real relaxation is like in maybe since med school type of thing. And so again, just to show you the disconnect between, we might think we're doing okay, but the okay might be relative until you experience what better actually feels like.
I love that. And you had totally engrossed Jeff. He was totally in the zone there. That was amazing to watch.
I mean, this is such a great topic, right? The mindset shifts to allow acceptance, right? Andy, we were just talking about this earlier today. You can spend a lot of time thinking about or rehearsing or replaying events that have already happened, or in this case of these stories, non-modifiables, right? At some point, like, you can analyze something to death, but at some point, and a lot of freedom that I've gotten professionally since starting to look at some of these things is identifying what areas of focus I can actually make a change in. And when I'm burning up my ATP, where is there going to be a positive movement rather than energy expenditure just spinning wheel? And that's been really helpful. And I'm very lucky that I work in a group and in a department that is very interested in helping identify that and doesn't really let you go down rabbit holes of busy work. like very early on, it was apparent when I was doing exactly what you were saying, John, hey, if only we just did this one thing, this process that in my mind is going to be perfect.
It would be amazing.
It would be amazing.
Everybody.
For everyone. And then
it would be awesome.
And then I would just sort of realize, oh, you know, I'm putting all this energy, all this expenditure, everything, and it's not going the direction that I wanted to. And after doing that for multiple instances, for multiple projects, I'm now getting much better at saying, you know, this probably isn't going to be, this is not an area to focus my energy.
I, by the way, loved your ATP comment, burning your ATP. And my head went to just funny thing. So it's basically medical brown fat. You burn all this energy, you don't go anywhere, and it just makes you hot.
That is exactly it.
That is it. I could totally see this, right? You spend all that energy and just like, all I am now is mad and I'm in the same spot.
Yep.
So Jason, I have a question about, you talk about the three things, right? When you identify somebody who realizes they need to just walk away, because I feel like that's one of our biggest hiccups in medicine, is that we have spent our entire lives being these A personalities. I'm going to solve a problem. I'm going to climb the top of the mountain. I'm never going to be wrong. I'm never going to miss. And that's an unhealthy cycle to get yourself stuck in. But when you diagnose that this is the person that needs to leave, how do you make them feel okay with that?
Can I preface it? You said comedy's allowed here. So there was a show 10 years ago, I think this show was on. It was called Inside the Actor's Studio. Are you familiar?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there was, the gist of it is there's an acting studio, a famous one in New York, and the main instructor has a show where he invites these big time actors, you know, Pacino, De Niro, those of that ilk. And they sit down and the entire acting class is the audience and they talk about the craft of acting. And Dave Chappelle was one of the, in my estimation, it was the best episode. And someone asked him the question. They said, you know, Dave, what was it like when you were first in comedy? What's it like to bomb? And he said, I don't know. I never did. And so to build off that, to answer your question, Andy, and I don't say this because I'm a superstar, I've never faced that. I've faced a ton of people who are at or near the cusp. And I would say the opposite happens. And I can, again, store stories. And I've had 1,000 conversations like this in my career, but one that sticks out. Maybe this is the first time I worked with that. And someone had come to me and said all the things that would suggest that maybe they're leaning towards this is no longer a fit for them. And of course, there's so much trepidation. Oh my God, but what would it mean for me to leave? I mean, what would people think and what would they say and what would I do? And I'm always a big believer when we ask ourselves the what and the why questions, typically we ask them, but we don't actually answer them. I said, so let's work it through. You know, what are you concerned about? Oh, this people won't understand and they'll be upset and this and that. And what about my husband and all the rest? And so we went through every single one of those scenarios and you realize, you know, what's the old saying? The only thing to fear is fear itself. That there was nothing tangible there. But the exercise was powerful because what that does is you go through it all and you realize, you know what? If I was to leave this, I think I'll be okay. Then guess what happens? I'm okay to step back in, knowing I have the ultimate leverage. And I've never to this day, literally knocking on wood, have had to advise someone to leave. That for somehow, some way, when it came to having those conversations, they just needed to know that they could and that that was enough to allow them to step back in.
That was not the answer I was expecting.
No, and I like that answer. So I'm going to lead in a different direction with a question and a confession in case people that listen don't already know. It turns out that emergency medicine physicians do have our favorite patients to treat and our least favorite patients to treat. You know, and it doesn't mean that they're not rewarding to treat. We all have them. Usually when you're new in emergency medicine, like a first or second year, it's generally the weak and dizzy. And you see it on the board and you're like, oh. Then you become an attending. You're like, oh, weak and dizzy. That's awesome. Yeah, totes easy. So your perspective for sure changes. But what is a type of patient, as you were, or a coaching benefactor that you work with that you either find challenging or frustrating, or it just kind of makes you pause a step, even if you power through it and love it, and in the end, it's all better. What on its face kind of makes you think, oh, that's going to be rough?
I think for me, it's more, I always tell people, I mean, if there's an expert here on you, it's not me. So I'm depending on you to do the things that you need to do. And I think you find people that genuinely want the changes they're committed to, but when the rubber hits the road, they're not. So that's the only thing I think for me. And it's not even a personal indictment. It's just if I was a personal trainer and gave you a exercise routine and you weren't willing to do it, it's nothing personal, but it's just, I have no value to you then. So for me, it's just the person that maybe for whatever the reasons, maybe there's just too much resistance preventing them from believing they can, but just the person who's unable or unwilling to invest. And I'll take it a step further. I've had for sure conversations wherein people have called me sort of in a last ditch type of way. And I've called them out on it. And I said, you know, I'll be honest with you. I think that you actually called me to be able to say, you know what? I've tried everything. I even called this bald guy coach's doctors and it didn't seem like he had anything to offer. And it gives them permission to stay stuck in whatever, you know, shitty situation and circumstances that they're perseverating on. So that is something to be on the alert for too. Conversely, I had a doctor call me one time. This was after SMAC. He'd saw me present there and he was struggling with engagement. He was probably about my age. I just turned 50 a few weeks ago. And it was at that point in his career where you're questioning the stuff that's building, that's frustrating and all the rest, you know, is it still worth it? So he started to tell me his story, and his story was all about all the things that were not working for him. And it just read like a negative fruit salad. And so we started talking. I said, okay, I got a feel for what's getting in the way. I said, let's go back in time. What got you in medicine in the first place? When it was good? Why was it good? What were you doing? And it's so interesting. He started to reveal to himself. He said, well, when it was good, when I wasn't pissed off at the system, I did more teaching and I did more research and I did more. And as he's saying that, he realized, he stopped doing all those things to punish medicine. But in fact, he punished himself. He took away the only things that kept him whole and sustainable and that gave him the juice. So we had a long conversation, and I'll never forget this quote. I've said it so many times. At the end, he said, you know, Jason, I'll be honest with you. I think I was calling you to get clear on an exit strategy, and you've helped me see I needed an engagement strategy. So I thought that was just so prophetic.
Yeah.
I want to go the opposite direction. So we talked about what are qualities of people that are physicians that you're like, oh, this might be a bit of a challenge. What are some qualities that you see in incredibly high-performing physicians that continue to sort of be that constant when you're talking to someone and really seeing them as optimizing themselves?
You know, it's funny, and this is something I get asked a lot too in terms of, it's the same answer. I'll get often asked, what's the most important team trait? It's the same answer to what I'm going to say for your question, and that is the people who are vulnerable and open are the best. Why? Because they're willing to do whatever it takes. They're not going to let their ego get in the way. And they just genuinely want to get better. And you think about if you have vulnerability in a team setting, especially like medicine. I did a course, and I still teach this course for 16 years. It's a health and high performance course for doctors. And in recent years, we brought in senior staff. And I asked them all the uncomfortable questions, imposter syndrome, mistakes, errors, what stresses you out, et cetera. And because they're so willing to show vulnerability to their learners, the learners exhale and go, first of all, I'm not the only one. Second of all, you're giving me permission to seek maybe the help and the supports that I need. So I think that's another trait. Because they're humble and because they're willing to be vulnerable, they show us in their actions that it's possible. And then they usually have that same humility pays itself back in terms of sharing their success or their discoveries with others. So that to me is the most important trait. I don't care what your background, I don't care any of that stuff. I just want someone who's genuinely here for the right reasons.
Yeah, I came across a quote that I really liked about decision points. Maybe we can close on this. And it's this idea of whenever you go to make a decision, sometimes our biggest issue with decisions are things we're afraid of. And it was whenever you go to make a decision, ask yourself the question, what would you do if you weren't afraid? Do you run across anything like that?
Oh, for sure. Half my talk tomorrow is about facing that inner critic. I'm a big believer in sort of this philosophy, and I think it helps people to navigate those situations this way. We all have that voice, right? And it all talks to us, particularly if it comes to big decisions, heavy decisions, stuff like that. And the trick of the mind is that mind is very good at convincing you that that voice is you. But it's not. I like to separate that. I see that voice as the cachet of the imposter and the fearful, all those stories and narratives. That's where that comes from. There's a part of you and you and you, all of us have that. You can call it the ego, the inner critic, the inner child. You can call it Larry for all I care. I don't matter. But we all have it. And so half the job is making sure that when I'm entertaining those thoughts and those feelings associated with it, the panic, the worry, the stress, etc., the first thing I need to do is recognize I am no longer perceiving my circumstances here. I am no longer accurately seeing things in front of me. And there's this beautiful quote from Neil Donald Walsh, and he says, fear is need announced. And I love that. So when I'm struggling or when I feel nervous or anxious or whatever, and those thoughts and feelings come up, I'm going to ask myself, I know that's not coming from me. It's coming from a part of me that's worried about some outcome or some uncertainty or what have you. And so I will literally talk to that part of me and ask it what it needs. And if any of you have kids here, I don't, but maybe some of you do. I always like to use this analogy. If one of your kids, when they were young, 3, 4 years old, if they came into your office and they were in a tizzy about something, you know, the sky was falling, what's the first thing as a parent you'd do? First thing, you'd show them some compassion. And as soon as they felt dad's loving support, the energy would calm down just enough where now dad's incredible perspective on things could have its work. We all have that inside of us. So how do I meet myself in that moment? First, take a pause. Recognize there's a part of me that needs something. It's scared. It's fearful. It's anxious. Okay, good news. It's not you. But what does it need? Needs some compassion. Hey, I'm feeling a little scared right now. I'm feeling a little worked up. This is a big decision. Okay, now that I feel that I've been acknowledged, what it requires then from the person, you, is some information to the counter. But in spite of how I'm feeling, I've made decisions like this before. I got a good team around me. I can talk to Jeff. I can talk to John. And next thing you know, I'm giving that part of me that's so wrapped up in the fear and the worry information that it could not see when it's in that state. When you're in a stressful state, what do you see? Threat and stress. That's it. But we think in that moment that that's me, and that's where we lose. I'm not advocating for split personalities here, just so you know. I'm advocating for, and again, I can't change the conditions. How do we meet ourselves better in those moments when that inner force, that inner energy, that inner critic is trying to hijack us away? You need to be the strength to that voice.
It's so good, though, because while you were talking about that, I was thinking of the exact time that I've seen Andy do that with one of his little ones who was having a moment, and it was, everything's okay, we're good. Now, and you just see his face like, oh, dad's got this. Like, he knows what to do. So that's very.
And just think of that voice. Okay, let's take that voice and let's go all the way back to residency. And, you know, every single day, the pressure to just be slightly better than you were yesterday, to just keep your head above water. And I always like to use the analogy. If you did 100 things in a day in residency and you did 97 of them, just fine. You don't have to be a superstar, but just fine. You get your classic 3 out of 5 for the day and run away happy. But it's that 3% that didn't go well. And it may not have been a huge error or whatever, but just you feel it wasn't to standard. What's the story of the day you take home? You got 97% on the test and yet you're beating yourself up, feeling like a failure because of the 3% you got wrong. And if I do that from residency forward, is there any wonder why 20 years into my career, I still struggle. I still don't feel confident. I still don't trust. I still am wrecked with imposter. Well, you've eliminated most of the data that would be the counter to that information. You've been so successful, you've never allowed any of that in. So look, I'm not one of these, hey, be positive types of guys at all. You know, we're designed to experience all the emotions, but could we be accurate? There's a lot of bullshit we're feeding ourselves about our capabilities that's causing interference.
That's so true. Well, I have to say, Jason, you've given us a ton to think about. I know that I have enjoyed it thoroughly. I can tell by you can't be in the room with me, but Andy and Jeff's faces, and I'm sure my own at several points had several great thoughts. I really appreciate that. And thanks so much for joining us here.
My pleasure, guys. Thanks for doing this. This is important, what you're doing. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right, and thanks for sticking around all the way to the end of that EM Over Easy episode. Don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, as well as on the blog site, emovereasy.com. And don't forget, the four of us, Drew, Tanner, John, and myself, will be live and in person at the upcoming ACOEP Spring Seminar in sunny Orlando, Florida, April 27th through May 1st. So head on over to acoep.org today to learn more about our two live shows and other great speakers from around the country and around EM. Until next time, thanks so much.